House Concurrent Resolution Number 2. Kim, would you like to state the general nature of this resolution and explain the effect of the proposed amendment?
This measure recognizes February 6th of each year as Ronald Reagan Day, and the amendment is a technical amendment adding the word "the" before the word "armed" in line 17, where it was unintentionally omitted.
All right, okay. Thank you. We have one witness, Representative Tim Canope. Would you like to come forward? And I think you know the drill. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. State Representative Tim Canope, House District 54. The reason I brought this memorial to you today, colleagues, is because actually we learned today, you know, wouldn't we have loved to have honored these folks before their untimely demise and dealing with the shuttle disaster? And I think it is appropriate to honor some of the figures in Oregon life and American life that have meant a great deal to our country. And what better way to honor them and let their families know and them know before they pass that they were, in fact, important. Obviously, Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, did a lot of things during his administration in a bipartisan way, since most of the time he had a Democratic Congress. And the resolution speaks to some of those things and some of those issues. Of course, he was the first president to deal with a Challenger, shuttle-type accident, and lead our country through that time as well, which is, I think, an interesting note for today. But many states around the country have, on past birthdays, honored him, and he is now the oldest living president ever. I think he was last year. And I think that's something to honor, because he did serve this country not only as the governor of California, as a union leader, as president, and, of course, as an entertainer. But I think he made a great impact in many ways on helping us win the Cold War, giving us our faith back. I remember times when people were talking in the late 70s that maybe the presidency was too big for one individual, and we need to split it up. And after his presidency, I haven't heard that talk since. So I think he's made a huge impact on this country, and just wanted to bring this resolution forward and see if we could get it to the floor, at least in the House, before his birthday, and continue to honor him on February 6th.
Well, thank you, Representative Canope. I, too, have great admiration for this president. I remember exactly where I was when the Challenger, and his words to the nation that night were very touching. So today, again, we're touched by history. Any questions for Representative Canope?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I'll close the public hearing on the House Concurrent Resolution 2 and open a work session on House Concurrent Resolution 2. Any discussion? I would entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay. Representative Gallegos, nervous here, moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to the House Concurrent Resolution 2. Any objections? Any discussion? I guess I should say first. Any objections? Hearing and seeing no objection, the motion carries.
Sure. Okay. Madam Chair, I move that House Concurrent Resolution 2 is amended to the House floor with a do pass adopt recommendation.
Representative Gallegos has moved the House Concurrent Resolution 2 as amended to the House floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Linda, will you call the roll?
Representative
Hunt?
Aye.
Representative March?
Aye.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Further?
Aye.
Chair Smith?
Aye.
So ordered. Representative Cope, would you like to carry the bill?
I'd be happy to announce some of your.
Did you like it, rather than Representative Knope?
Is it also steal his thunder?
I'm happy to do it now.
All right. Representative Knope will be the carrier. Thank you. I open a public hearing on House Bill 2295. Kim, would you state the general nature of the bill and explain the effect of the proposed amendments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. House Bill 2295 would permit winery licensees in the state of Oregon to ship to residents of Oregon not more than two cases of what is commonly known as hard cider per month for personal use. The amendments before the committee, the Dash 1 amendments, would permit winery licensees to ship to residents outside of Oregon also not more than two cases of cider per month for personal use. Shipment to non-Oregon residents would be limited to states that allow receipt of cider and do not require the Oregon shipper to pay additional taxes in that state. The Dash 2 amendments before the committee would not include the shipment of interstate, would not include interstate shipment, but would merely change the bill as currently drafted to two cases of wine or two cases of cider rather than and two cases of cider.
Thank you. First witness we have is Roger Mansfield. Would you please come forward? Looks like he's got company. Welcome, Mr. Mansfield. And for the record, would you state your name?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Roger Mansfield. My address is 1720 Southwest Jericho Lane in the beautiful and scenic community of Culver, Oregon. And I'm here representing the Traditional Company, which is a winery that I own. Also with us today is Kristen Ford, who is the owner of Ford Farms Cider Works, and Alan Foster, the owner of the winery White Oak Cider. Between the three of us, we are the three primary wineries producing cider in the state of Oregon. And we're here before you today to request your support and approval of House Bill 2295, which, as Kim has indicated, would allow Oregon wineries to ship cider directly to consumers within the state, and as amended, the bill is amended to customers outside of the state of Oregon. To give you a little background about cider, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, cider is controlled by the federal government as well as the state of Oregon. Under the U.S. Code of Federal Regulation, cider is defined as a fruit wine from fermented apple or pear juice, and typically the alcohol content is below 7%, and which is about half of what a typical grape wine would be. In order to produce cider in the state of Oregon, you're required to have a U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms winery permit, as well as a state of Oregon winery permit, and as I say, the three producers currently in Oregon are the three of us. We're all relatively small wineries, family operations. We all are orchardists as well. We produce our fruit that goes into our cider. And I think you all should know and be proud that our cider is recognized the world over for its outstanding quality, and our reputation is so great. We've got people from all over the world beating on our doors trying to buy our cider, and that's why we're here before you today. We have a bit of a problem. We'd love to sell it to them, but Oregon laws are putting a crimp in our ability to do that. And the areas where we've got some problems are, there are three areas. First of all, Oregon laws discriminate against wines, fruit wines, especially made from apples or pears, as opposed to any other wine. I'll embellish on these in just a moment. Second of all, Oregon laws allow out-of-state cider producers a competitive advantage in terms of selling to residents in the state of Oregon, which we're precluded from doing. And third, Oregon laws currently preclude us from selling out of state. So we're unable to reach out-of-state markets that we could actually tap if we had the ability to do that. And to go back to the first one, when I say it's discriminated against, we as winery owners, we can make wines out of just about anything, you know, strawberries, peaches, cherries, rhubarb, you name it, we can do it. And we can ship it to residents within the state as well as out of the state. However, if we make a wine out of apples or pears, Oregon law says we can't ship it to residents within the state, and we also cannot ship it out of the state. When I say we're at a competitive disadvantage to producers in other states, as I think Kim alluded to, with the reciprocal wine laws that are in place for Oregon and other surrounding states, Oregon allows direct shipments of wine to residents within the state of Oregon. And because the states allow or have taken the interpretation that cider is a fruit wine, they have gone ahead and are actually selling to residents and shipping to residents in the state of Oregon. We're precluded from doing that same thing. So basically, out-of-state producers are getting a competitive advantage over the homegrown producers. And third, we're precluded from selling to people outside of the state of Oregon that want to buy it. As I mentioned earlier, the quality of our ciders are truly exceptional. They're world class. And we all routinely get calls saying, hey, I'd love to get some of your cider. You know, how can I get it? And we have to, you know, tell them, hey, we got a problem. We can't sell it to you. I'd love to sell it to you, but we can't. And so I think, you know, in summation, I would just say that we've got a we're sort of behind the eight ball here in terms of being at a competitive disadvantage to other producers, and we're hoping with the passage of House Bill 2295 as amended, we can correct that, which would allow us to ship directly to consumers both within the state and out of the state. It's a privilege that any other wine produced, whether it's made out of fruit, berries, or grapes, enjoys, with the exception of cider. And we're asking that that same right and privilege be extended to cider as well. I just would conclude that, you know, we would ask your approval and active support for the passage of this very important legislation for the cider producers of Oregon. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Do you want to give testimony, Kristen or Alan?
Well, I would like to say by
could
way
you
of
state your name.
Sorry.
That's okay.
My name is Alan Foster. My wife and I own White Oak Cider outside of Newburgh. By way of illustration, to Roger's point of the interest that our ciders have generated, not only nationally, but actually internationally, I got a call from a fellow in Massachusetts, a chef who will be hosting a cider symposium in Montreal coming up in March. And there will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 250 chefs from around the world meeting there. His tasting is full. They had enough room for 100 people, and he's bringing in ciders and cider-related beverages from France, from England, a great deal from the northeastern part of the United States, and really wanted to have our ciders there as a representation. We're, our cidery is one of two in the nation that produces a varietal cider made from an apple called Kingston Black. He'll be getting this cider from England. He would like to compare what we do with these apples as related to what they do with them in England, which they've been working with for some 200 years. I felt quite honored that our reputation has spread that far and that he indeed was interested in having us represented and also giving these various chefs a frame of reference as to the varietal distinctions among ciders. I might also add that the three of us don't make six-pack ciders. You're not going to find them, you know, at Fred Meyer's in a six-pack selling for $6.99. These are premium beverages that are going to retail at $10 a bottle for a 750-milliliter bottle at least. So this, for us, we're a niche within a niche. Marketing this type of cider is a challenge, and we're kind of redefining what ciders are for Americans, and we're somewhat the evangelists for old world ciders in the new world. But I would like to say we appreciate your listening to our testimony and considering our statements. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Foster. I think I'm just beginning to learn how sheltered a life I really live. any questions? Steve?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hopefully, I mean, you're all small producers, I presume, at this rate, and I assume if we pass this, you'll all of a sudden become large producers and hire lots of folks, stimulating the economy greatly. Or just maybe a little bit bigger.
We could hire our children.
Well, I think that's a good point, and I think the committee should be aware that to the extent that we're more successful at marketing our ciders, the state of Oregon is a direct beneficiary from the standpoint that we end up paying more privilege taxes and more state income taxes. So I think that's one of the positive spin-off effects of being able to do this.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just really wanted to commend you all for stepping up. I mean, a lot of times I think people complain about some restriction in a regulation of government. And you're a good example of actually stepping up, seeing the problem, coming up with a solution, and bringing it forward to the legislature. And I'm sure you're going to get strong support from this committee. So I don't have a question. Just wanted to commend you for being good citizens and following through.
He obviously likes cider. Thank you, Representative Hunt. Any other questions for Representative Berger?
Madam Chair, thank you. Did I understand you to say that you represent pretty much the cider industry in the state of Oregon?
Yes.
My question is, are you prepared for, as a result of this huge competition? You realize that we are opening the door here for others. Besides yourselves.
That's certainly not a problem. I think, we would be open, would be happy to have other entrants into the marketplace. And I think what we're trying to do is, eliminate as many roadblocks to people who want to have a cider offering. Because I think truly Oregon stands out in the country and actually in the world in terms of the quality of the products that we offer. And we certainly don't have a problem about welcoming additional competitors.
Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Yes.
Then I would say that if the quality of our apples and pears is reflected in your cider, we've got a huge market ready to go.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Any other questions? I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2295 and open a work session on 2295. Representative March?
Yes, Madam Chair. Do we need to take the dash 1 and dash 2 separately, or can we do them combined?
I think we can just do the dash 1 amendments, and they are alternative provisions.
All right. Well, I would move the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2295, Madam Chair.
Representative March moves the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2295. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection, the motion carries.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2295 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative March has moved House Bill 2295 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation and rescission of the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Linda, will you call the roll?
Representative
Hunt?
Aye.
Representative
March?
Aye.
Representative
Richardson?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative
Toledo? Aye.
And Chair Stone?
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative March, would you like to carry the bill?
Be happy to.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. like to open an informational meeting for the purpose of providing overview information to the committee on issues related to Oregon ports. It is our honor to be joined today by Keith Levitt, representing the Port of Portland, and Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Ports Group. Do you want to come together, or do you want to?
Yes,
sure.
Together, Madam Chair.
Why not? Okay.
Thank you.
Well, who wants to go first? Or do you have that all worked out?
Well, I think we'll. Keith, you want to go ahead and go first?
Well, welcome for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the chance to be here. My name is Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland. And I have some informational pieces that are being handed out to you right now. What I thought I would do, and Ken can talk about ports generally in the state, I thought I would just give you a sense for what our mission is, who we are, what we do at the Port of Portland briefly, and then talk about some challenges that we're facing over the next several years, and hopefully end up with highlighting some of the issues that will be in front of you this legislative session. The Port of Portland is a local government, but we're really a hybrid between local state government as well as the private sector. The reason I say that is our jurisdiction is in the metro area of Portland, Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties, and however, our commission, we have a nine-member commission that is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. So we have a relationship there through the state, and our clientele is really statewide. In fact, I would say that our business stakeholders largely reside outside of the metro area more than they do inside, and that's largely because the products that are coming through the Port of Portland are coming from throughout Oregon, particularly in the agriculture sector. The port's mission is to provide access to regional, national, and international markets. In performing that mission, we own and operate five marine terminals in the Portland area with business lines that include general cargoes like steel slabs that come in and out of the area, break bulk cargoes, containerized cargo, the import and export of autos, and the export, particularly of grain. We are a world leader. The Lower Columbia River is second in the world as a corridor for the export of grain. And we also are a major player in the export of mineral bulks. And I'll highlight that for a moment. The Portland really sits, the reason that it is such an export corridor and an export port is because of the agricultural area of the Pacific Northwest, but it's also because of the transportation connections. It's really a funnel that comes down through the Columbia River, through the gorge. We have two Class I railroads that serve our region, which is quite unique. And the ability to have unit trains that come all the way from the Midwest into the Portland area that traverse the mountains at the river grade, which again allows for efficient movement of rail into this area. We also benefit greatly from Interstate 5 and Interstate 84, giving north-south and east-west connections on the road. And I would say the number one reason that the Portland is the port that it is because we sit on a river system about 105 miles inland for deep draft navigation, but then 465 miles inland all the way to Lewiston, Idaho for barge traffic. That is a unique system, one of the most unique in the country, if not the world, and it is the number one containerized product on barge system in the country. So that whole network is able to feed products and commerce down towards Portland, towards other lower Columbia River ports to put on the larger vessels off to market. That's kind of the marine side. We also own and operate four airports, PDX plus three general aviation airports in Hillsborough, Troutdale, and Molino. We have six industrial parks. And in total, the port is an economic engine for the state. The aviation-related jobs statewide and throughout the region are about 76,000 that are influenced by our aviation, as well as 53,000 on the marine side. So it's a significant economic asset for the state, returning about $203 million annually to local and state government for revenue. We have many challenges as we look off into the next 3, 5, 10-year horizon. We are in the middle of a strategic planning process, and several key issues have been prioritized out of that process. And I just wanted to highlight four of those. One is financial viability. And this is a consistent theme for all Oregon ports, if not for local government generally. When we passed Measure 5, Measure 4750 in this state, ports in particular decreased their reliance on property taxes. They had to, and at the Port of Portland, we currently, our property tax revenue is about 3% of our operating revenue. So in other words, about 97% comes from the private sector that we work with. And because of that, we have done some things over the 90s financially to essentially make sure that we're able to generate enough revenue to operate. And we can continue to do that as we look forward. But where we are going to struggle and where our strategic plan shows that we're going to struggle is in the area of capital infrastructure. Many of you have been down to our terminals before. It's a very capital-intensive operation to run a marine terminal. An example of an item that we really ought to be purchasing if we want to stay competitive is a couple of post-Panamax container cranes. Those are for the large ships that come, the container vessels that are on the river today, larger cranes to be able to reach around the vessels and pull the products, pull the containers off. Those are about $8 to $12 million per crane. And we, as we look off into the short-term horizon, we're going to need to find a way to finance a capital project like that. We have several strategies, including finding new business revenues. But we will probably also be talking to you next session to see if there is a possibility for state investment in some sort of capital facility that has a statewide benefit. Next major challenge for the port is marine access, and the most obvious issue there is the channel deepening project. We currently have a navigation channel that's maintained at 40 feet by the Corps of Engineers. That's a depth that, frankly, is outdated, and we've had a project going on now for a long time. I'm sure you all, some of you are very aware of it. Representative Hunt, I'm sure you've heard of it, and it is, we're now in about the 15th year of study and review of that project. We are hopeful that we are nearing the end of the review process and literally can move to the construction phase within this calendar year. There is very much possibility for delay. We know there's going to be lawsuits on this project, but the good news is that when you've got two states that are reviewing the project, you have federal agencies and the federal government and Congress that have to authorize and fund the project. We are just about at the end of the process part of this whole thing, and that's quite a milestone. The project has been blessed by the National Marine Fisheries Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service with their no jeopardy opinion with regard to its impact on endangered species. From Clean Water Act perspective, the states are just now finishing up their review, and we expect the project will be able to move forward. International Air Service is the next major challenge. Some of you may recall that when Delta was serving Portland with daily nonstop service to Asia, we were enjoying that service from about the mid-80s till literally about a year and a half ago. And Delta decided to cease that service. And what it really did was symbolize the challenge that a mid-market size population like Portland, like Oregon, has in attracting international air service. And so we have retooled, if you will, our marketing approach to air carriers and basically what we've been trying to do has come up with strategies that demonstrate a strong business case for a carrier to come in and make money but also show a lot of organized business desire for the flight. We have aggregated in the case that led to Lufthansa coming to Portland. We were able to aggregate business demand for the flight. Our goal is $10 million, and we were able to surpass that. And what that is literally companies signing up in advance for commitments for business class seats. And we were able to take a package and put it in front of Lufthansa, work with them, and they're going to start service in late March. And that's a real boost to us. That's a boost to our economy. And you'll see on the I put a one-pager in your packet there. People may not realize that there are a lot of jobs just connected with a beginning a service like this. We expect 1,500 jobs to be influenced by that, and more business revenue and so on. The issue that we're going to have with international air service and with making Lufthansa a success is not really from demand in Oregon to go to Germany or Europe, but it's going to be from branding Oregon, increasing Oregon's visibility in Germany to German citizens, to Europeans, to use this flight to come back here, spend their money, and help our economy grow. So we are supporting the tourism investment proposal that is in front of your committee now, House Bill 2267. Oregon has been one of the lowest funded tourism states in the country, and we are at a time right now where it's important that we invest in tourism promotion and let the rest of the country and the world know that we're open for business. And that's why we're on board with that proposal. Next major area for international air service is to look to Asia again, and Lufthansa is a key there. They're involved in the Star Alliance with other Asian carriers as part of that alliance. So if we can have a success on the European side, it will help us greatly as we market towards Asia. We're in the middle of active discussions with Mexicana Airlines for direct service down to Mexico. So there's some good, I think, some positive activity going on the international air service front. Finally, the major challenge is trade-related infrastructure. From our vantage point, as you think of what to do for economic recovery in the state, a transportation package is key. We are seeing more and more how important it is for businesses to be able to move products, particularly to international markets, and do so in a way that they can predict the delivery of that product. It's very important. Air service, air freight is the fastest growing part of the ports business, and the ability to get products literally from just even Hillsboro to PDX to meet the flight is sometimes quite difficult for those of us who have to drive on Highway 26 and then all the way out to PDX from there. So trade-related infrastructure is a very important item. If there is going to be a transportation package this session, we are hopeful that it deals with the bridges, but it also has a balanced approach between maintaining the current system as well as hopefully some modernization projects that are geared towards the best investment for the economy. Finally, I just wanted to mention this session you have. I mentioned House Bill 2267. You also have a bill coming up that we are very supportive of, House Bill 2252, regarding the International Trade Commission, expanding the role and further identifying the role for that commission, we think is very important. Channel deepening, if there is delay in the project, we will need to come back to the legislature to reauthorize the decision that was made last session to provide state funding. That'll probably be a ways and means issue. We are frankly hoping that we will not have to do that because the project will move forward. And finally, I mentioned this to your counterpart committee in the Senate, the Oregon Business Plan that was worked on by the Oregon Business Council and many others, including those of us at the port, we're very supportive of that plan, and to the extent there is, and I believe there is, a need to go through the plan and develop a legislative strategy behind a lot of those components. One of the most important pieces in there is industrial land, and we in the metro area, as well as I know statewide, industrial land is very scarce and is going to be a very top priority economic development issue for our region, I think our state, and dealing with that issue is going to be a real important thing to do for economic recovery. I know there's a lot of other parts of that plan, and we stand ready to work with you and hopefully help provide some clarity to the parts of the plan that need legislative action this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levin. Are there any questions for Mr. Levin? Representative March?
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much industrial land does the port have currently available, vacant and or developed and ready to lease out?
Madam Chair, Representative March, I don't have a specific answer for you there, but I can tell you that our industrial property has gotten down to where we have one major parcel left that is of the 70 acre or so variety. We have smaller parcels, but the real scarcity, particularly in the metro area, is the larger parcels that are ready to go, shovel ready, as everyone keeps saying, is what is lacking. I can get you a more specific answer, though.
Thanks.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Levitt, you mentioned that one of our competitive advantages is we can go all the way to Lewis and Idaho to bring grain in by barge, which most ports can't get that far deep. Is that a growing or a sort of shrinking part of our market? Are barges still viable, or are there fewer and fewer and less, and it's more on trucks going the other way or whatever over, say, the last 10 years?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, that barge traffic for grain, because grain has been, the price of grain has been such a problem over the last, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years, volumes have not been as high as they typically have been in the past. But we don't see that the need to export the grain that we are growing here, the demand is still there, and the market goes up and down, and we don't expect it to stay down forever. So you would see that over the last eight or so years, volumes are down, but we don't expect that to be a trend. It's more indicative of the fact that the Asian market has been in the where it's been lately. Containerized cargo, I should say, also on the river has gone up over the last 10 years. And the more you see value-added agriculture, whether it's frozen French fries, packaged vegetables, even hay cubes, that type of value-added product has increased and is really a real success story in rural parts of the state, like in the Hermiston area, where you can have manufacturing done there and you're not just shipping the bulk product to the foreign market.
Thank you, Paul. And what you're saying is that value-added product is being put on barges and coming down to the port?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Berger, that's correct. That's, in fact, about 25% of the containerized cargo that we see at Terminal 6 is coming from that upriver system. Port of Morrow in Boardman was the number one container on barge port in the country.
Thank you. Mr. Representative Hunt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You alluded in your opening comments to some degree to the reach of the jobs that's not just the Tri-County area. Can you maybe expand on that a little bit, both in terms of air freight and on the marine side, how dispersed the jobs are around the whole state of Oregon and what types of jobs those are?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, the direct jobs on the docks, the longshore, for instance, those are all very high-paying, very good jobs. And then as you get beyond, you kind of go up the chain there, and you can get all the way to influence jobs throughout the state, whether it's the farming, agriculture, or on the air side, it can be the restaurant and tourism industry. The level of pay for these jobs, we've got good data on that. These are all nice paying family wage jobs. I don't know if that's getting specifically to your question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Ken Armstrong, and I'm the director of the Oregon Ports Group. I'm going to shift gears just a little bit. A lot of what you're going to hear from me is similar to what you heard from Keith, but it's a question of scale and it's a question of geography. The Oregon Ports Group, well, back up just a little bit more. There are 23 ports in the state of Oregon, including the Port of Portland. Most of which are members of my organization. Not all of them are, and they run a whole spectrum of activities, from Port of Coquille River that does nothing more than remove snags from the river, that sort of a thing, to all the way up to the Port of Portland. So it's a very broad spectrum of activities, and I'm going to try and just give you a broad sense of what Oregon ports are all about. Several of you I've talked with about port issues. Some of you we haven't talked at all about them, so I'd be more than happy to spend any more time with you on an individual basis, but kind of the thumbnail sketch is this. Ports are units of local government. They are creatures of the legislature. What we can do is what statute tells us that we can do. They are, with the exception of the Port of Portland and the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay, whose commissions are gubernatorially appointed, the commissions are elected at the local level and have tax bases that are typically quite small. Most of the revenues of ports come from revenue-generating activities. And I'm going to talk about some of those revenue-generating activities here in a minute. I think it's useful to think of ports in two different ways. There's kind of two chief operating activities in which ports operate. One is in the business development side, and then one I'll say is I'll call the port development side, or we also might call that transportation side. The business development side is particularly useful, I think, to you for as we look right now at an environment where state revenues are down, the economy is suffering, and our unemployment rate is high. Ports are in a very unique position to be in partnership with the state of Oregon to realize both short-term and long-term job creation. We have had traditionally very close working relationships with the state, particularly with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department and also with the Department of Transportation. You may or may not know, in years past, we have had, in fact, a ports division within the Economic and Community Development Department, which was tasked solely with managing the programs that are used by ports and being a resource to ports in conducting their charge of job creation and economic development. On the ODOT side, there are certainly funding programs there that we're involved with. We're very close to the agency and to the state with respect to the transportation financing packages that have been discussed over the last 10, 12 years. More recently, and this was when Mr. Levitt and I made a presentation to your counterpart committee on the other side of the building, I gave a brief summary of my role as chairman of the Freight Advisory Committee under ODOT, a bill that we as the ports got passed last session. And that has been a tremendously useful tool increasing the profile of freight within the state of Oregon. But the business development activities that ports are most actively involved in include development of commercial and industrial sites, issuing bonds for economic development projects, kind of a whole range of activities of things that you can think of as non-transportation, but are site development, project development. There's a tremendous amount of that going on. You can think in some terms of those ports that are heavily in that activity almost as landlord ports, that they own industrial commercial property, they develop it, they lease it to businesses or other entities for job creation purposes, and that's the whole reason that they exist in those areas. Then there's the port development side. And that has much more to do with the transportation infrastructure, maintenance and construction dredging, as Keith has already talked about, such as the Columbia River Channel Project. Marina development, that's a classic port activity. That's not typically a profitable line of business for the private sector. Ports do that often simply because that is a benefit to the community, and it's a benefit in the sense of tourism and generating dollars in the community, and ports are very, very active in that activity. Warehousing and other freight support infrastructure are things that ports are active in. Of course, docks, wharves, rail spurs, that whole sort of thing. Airports. There's a wide range of transportation activities that ports are involved with in terms of sponsoring it with the ground itself and partnering with a private sector individual or company, working with the state, working with the railroads, or just simply developing it on their own property with their own resources. There's a wide range there. So I think that helps give you a sense of the two sides of the business for ports. Some of the priorities that ports are looking at right now include access to capital. And quite frankly, one of our highest priorities this session is the Economic and Community Development Department's budget going through the Ways and Means process. We access the Marine Navigation Improvement Fund, which is obviously a very key player with respect to the Columbia River Channel Deepening Project. There are many smaller navigation improvement projects that we're looking at around the state. We have the Oregon Port Revolving Fund, which is a loan program through the state of Oregon, and ports have used that extensively over the years to develop incubator facilities, T-hangers at airports, just a whole range of types of projects to bring industry into the port communities and develop job creation and investment. State investment in multimodal freight infrastructure, that's what Keith mentioned earlier, transportation funding package. We're going to be big supporters of that this session, and we'll play any role that we can in helping facilitate that. And then finally, streamlined permitting and regulatory oversight. Ports are governmental entities, but we operate at the speed of business, and that's a very different sort of a role from most other municipalities. As the chair knows, when you get a project on hand, they need to be able to move very quickly. And if you get hung up from the standpoint of permitting, regulatory issues, all the way over to the ability of the state to process the dollars that you're going to access, whether it be a revolving fund, a grant, any one of a number of things, that can hold up the project, and we can see projects go elsewhere. Maybe elsewhere in the state, but often elsewhere in the country. And we it's a tight environment. We all know that. And ports can be an outstanding tool to get this job creation in the rural parts of the state as well as the metro parts of the state, but we need to be given the tools to do that. Generally speaking, you've already heard Keith talk about the Columbia River. That functions very well as a unified transportation chunk of infrastructure, if you will, from the ports of Morrow and Umatilla, connecting down to Portland and then out into the international areas. That is a connected system. It's a network. There, of course, also are ports that don't play that role, but they're on the Columbia River, thinking of Cascade Locks that operates the Sternwheeler. Of course, Hood River has a wide variety of activities going on there. The coast is much more community-driven, with the exception of Newport and Coos Bay, which does have some international trade activities. Most of the rest of the coastal ports are community-driven. They are vital to their communities from the standpoint of tourism, commercial, and recreational fishing, and those have become much more important since the declines in the timber industry and also, of course, in the fishing industry as we've seen things start to concentrate on certain areas of the coast. So please remember that ports do play a critical role in local and statewide economic development efforts. We will do anything that we can to help you as you move forward this session to stimulate job creation. It's a tough task, and I realize this has just been sort of an informational overview, but we'll do everything we can to try and make your job easier, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Armstrong. Any questions? Representative March?
Yes, thank you, Ken. You mentioned that marina development was not profitable, and certainly in some jurisdictions of some states it is, but could you clarify?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative March, typically speaking, marinas, and I'm speaking very generally, there's obviously going to be exceptions to this, but they are not typically a huge profit center. And because of the amount of investment that you need to make on, you know, keeping the area free of debris, and when you get material that starts to silt in, that's got to be cleaned out. The upkeep on the facilities themselves can be terribly expensive, and it is a oftentimes it is a industry. I'm talking about the boat owners that can be fairly fluid. They can move to another facility just as easily as they can stay there. So the profit margins are pretty small, and the investment can be fairly high. But it's also an area where if you make those investments, you're going to see continued and increased tourism activities there. We see that at the port of Brookings in particular. They're a very active commercial and recreational fishing port, and they get lots of activity as a result of that. So, you know, it really just kind of depends on which specific operation we're talking about. But typically, it's not a big money making operation.
You have a follow up? Okay.
Thank you. Is Portland, Keith, a port of call for any major shippers? And what is there anything being done that the state is doing, the port is doing, to try to bring that about?
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, when you say major shippers, you mean major companies that are identifying Portland that they want their products going through Portland? I'll answer this way. We are a port of call for the businesses, the shippers in this region that need to reach international markets. It's a natural, based on geography and the efficiency of getting their products to Portland. What we are out there looking for, and it, when you're running the container terminal, you really need a balance of imports to exports. We are imbalanced right now, exports, and I think it's something like 4 containers to 1. Don't hold me to that, but it's something. It's close to that imbalanced. What that does to you is it makes it a little more expensive for carriers because they have to find empty containers. You always have either too many empties at one time in your marketplace or you don't have enough. And so you do need if you had a major company in the United States that was willing to say, I want to bring, whether it, maybe it's Nike, I want to bring my products through Portland on the inbound ship and put it on rail and send it off to the rest of the country from here, that would help us quite a bit. And we don't have right now that I'm aware of very much what they call intermodal traffic, which is basically traffic that comes in here, is put on rail or truck and sent to other places around the country. And major driver in that is population size. And again, our kind of mid-size population makes it more difficult for containers in particular for imports. You see Puget Sound, much larger population, and clearly LA Long Beach is the load center. It's where most of your container imports are coming in.
Thank you. Representative
Hines. Thanks, Madam Chair. Ken, you mentioned the importance of permit streamlining, regulatory reform as a as a key component, the way we can be more supportive of ports and really of business in general as a state. Are there any specific list of regulatory reform or streamlined permitting recommendations that you would envision yourself as a ports group bringing in the future, or do you look to some other list? Because I think that's a key hope of this committee is pursuing those kind of reforms.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, I can give you a couple of examples. We worked throughout this current interim, or just the most recent interim, with the Department of Environmental Quality to address an issue that was very problematic for us, and that was the cost of 401 water quality certification. To make a quite long story short, we were concerned about the process that was in place to originally develop those costs, the fee structure for the permits. We worked throughout the interim with the Department of Environmental Quality to come up with a restructure of that. That ended up working, and you're not seeing a bill before you this session. So that's an example of a type of a streamlining that we were involved with, that we were able to achieve, and that would need to see duplicated elsewhere. Something that you will see in front of you is a bill that we're bringing and could find itself in this committee, is dealing with Division of State Lands royalties on dredged material. We're trying to bring into clearer focus circumstances under which the use of those dredged materials is exempt from paying a royalty when it's not. There's some the statute needs some clarity, and administrative rule needs some clarity, and that will help us in the ability, we think, to take some of that material, use it for constructive, beneficial uses, and not have it be exceptionally expensive to do so when the public is benefiting from it. So that's an example of something we're trying to work through. From just a general streamlining standpoint, within the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, we're trying to work with them to see if we can find out better ways to deliver program dollars quicker, so that when you've got a potential employer online that is interested in a piece of property of the ports, that we can get through the process much quicker to making application for the dollars, getting approved, getting the dollars out into the hands of the port so they can do, you know, whatever the improvement is that needs to be done. It's those kinds of things. Now, if I pulled my ports, I'm sure each one of them would have a different issue that they think is the most important streamlining piece to develop. And I think that's a critical thing for the state to take a look at, is how can we improve the ability of not just ports but the whole state of Oregon to get businesses sited quickly, obviously not running over the top of environmental and land use issues that need to be dealt with, but what's the fastest that we can make these things happen, because it takes a while to have the actual economy turn around, and that's what we want to try and do. So that's just kind of a flavor of where the ports would be coming from.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you both. I think you addressed one of my concerns, is the streamlining. How do you do that? It's so difficult. But that is one of the focuses we have to focus on. So thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, I'll close the informational hearing. And members, I'd like a motion to request unanimous consent to allow Representative House to record his vote on HCR 2 as amended. Representative Gallegos?
Sure. Madam Chair, I move that the committee allow unanimous consent to allow Representative House to record his vote on the HJR 2 as amended.
Thank you, Representative Gallegos. I have a motion. Any objections? Representative House? Linda? Motion carries. Thank you. There's no other business to come before the committee at this time. We are adjourned, but I would ask that you stay a few minutes.